James, real 35. So you got on the hospital ship, and we're at that stage of your experiences. Can you remember any of the other casualties that were with you besides the Americans? Any other DLI men at this stage?
Well, there was another man on board called Fisher. He was a Jewish chap, I think. Well-built chap with a moustache. And he was another casualty
from the DLI.
of the DLI. Fisher, his name was. And I saw him on the boat quite by chance. But I forget what he was, but he was walking wounded. He was walking wounded. And we were both commenting on this wonderful matron, this wonderful Red Cross nurse, who incidentally lost her life when the St. David was diving at Anzio, and we were involved in that operation. And she went down with the ship, and she was drowned. And I was very, when I heard that St. David was dive-bombed and sank at Anzio, and she went down, I was very, very sad. Anyway, she saw me, and she looked at my ear, and she said, "Well, we shall soon be crossing the Med back to Caserta, where you're going into the American hospital. So don't bother to clean up, just wait until you land, and then go into hospital, and they will attend to you." But she said, "You do require medical attention, and it has to be, this separation has to be arrested, and you do need treatment. It shouldn't be too long, maybe 2 weeks." So she gave me a few words because of that. I've never met that woman. I gave her the Red Cross office door now, I put a couple of quid in there, in the box, in memory of her. We arrived at the ship eventually arrived at Bizerta, and all these American ambulances were lined up waiting for the casualties. They were whipped to the hospitals, and I was whipped to the ENT department of the 103rd American General Hospital.
And what's ENT? What's that stand for?
Ear, nose, and throat. When I was sort of cursory examined, ENT department. And I was told, "That's the department you're going into." When I arrived there, I was examined by an American doctor who had a German name. His name was Dr. Deutsch, and he was a specialist in ear problems. And but he was a senior specialist as well in the ENT department. I was sent for, and he looked at my ear and asked me how long had he been separating, and I told him for about 10 days or so, from day two of Salerno. And so he asked, "Was it painful?" I said, "Yes, it was. It was very painful inside the ear." So he said, "Well, he will be giving me some revolutionary treatment." He washed away the sticky, hard, crusty separation stuff, and got down to clean the ear. And with his co-specialist, decided what they were going to do to me. So they had some special new white powder, which was antiseptic or something, or it has some properties anyway. And he said that he was going to experiment on me. I had a very large perforation in the ear. And it was a very, very large. And he said I would eventually lose my hearing completely in that ear. And that when he changed me, I must on no account ever put anything in that ear, such as cotton wool or any plug of any sort, or even any earpiece of any sort. I must not put anything in that ear because it will cause separation again, and inflammation, and good stuff lot. So, the treatment was, first of all, there was some transparent liquid pumped the liquid into this ear, and it went through the eustachian, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, eustachian tubes, or eustachian tubes, whatever they are. It's good from the ear to the back of the nose and the throat. But this fluid that he pumped forcefully through this ear came out of my nose, which was a great surprise to me. And he kept on doing this, washing it out, mitigating with this stuff. And then he, the next day, pumped a white powder into this yana. And it stemmed the separation. I'm not sure, I didn't think it immediately stopped it or stemmed it. But eventually, anyway, I had some more white powder, some more cleaning up, and then he left me with an air and presumably a suture tube, chop a block with this white powder. Now, I didn't know the name of the powder once, but it was some sort of antiseptic stuff and some sort of curative stuff that I knew about. And then I rested, and he examined me daily, examined the other year, which wasn't perforated, but obviously he said that I will be suffering some loss because of the initial bomb blast. And the shell blast and the mortar-borne blast didn't do any good. And he thought that after a stay in his hospital, he examined me every day, he thought that I'd have guinea pig treatment. And this was a new treatment by the American ENT people for people in action with saturation.
Mm-hmm.
So after about a fortnight, I seemed to be sort of although he said, it's time now for us to say goodbye. And you're going to leave us. If you are in the vicinity of the one of the hospital of the future, wherever you might be, pop in and see me. I should be very interested in your case. He was later at Naples, and I went to Naples to see him there, with also a couple of nice nurses who took to me in the one of the general hospital. One was called Fritzi. She was a lieutenant, and she was a darling. And she was a nurse who looked after me, actually. And the other one, I forget the other one's name, because she was a blonde. But these lieutenant, these nurses, all had lieutenant rank. And they were beautiful women. They were lovely. And I got a photograph of myself with Fritzi in Naples, somewhere in my pile. That I went to see her for the day, and also Dr. Deutsch. He wanted to know how I was getting on. He told me that I wouldn't be fit for the front line anymore, because I would be deaf in my right ear, and that I would no doubt be downgraded to the British Army, and that the first thing I could do when I rejoin the British units is to see a British specialist, and probably go before the medical board, he was right. When the time came, about 2 weeks later, they were discharging the people who were fit to be discharged into the American Reception Center, which was a terrible place. The Americans must have a load of soldiers who, on becoming casualties or going to hospital, try to swing the lead or dodge rejoining operation units, but they made their lives unbearable at this reception center, including my life. When I arrived at this reception center, it was like being in prison. It was like, of all the world, like a British Army correction center. There were tall bullies with Boy Scout hats in the American Army, and they are special chaps in the American Army prisons, where I've always seen on the films. They're dressed differently from the others. They've got gators up their legs, and they've got this Boy Scouts flat hat and big white brim, dead on. And they're all about 6'2", and they're bullies. So, he didn't realize that he was talking to a British warrant officer. He was an American top sergeant, which was an American sergeant major, I suppose. But everybody of all nationalities in this ex-hospital reception center out every morning to make their lives unbearable. He said, I'm going to make you busy here so that you regret coming here, but, you know, he said, I'm having no lead swingers here. He said, what you're doing, he said, you'll be carrying heavy rocks from one end of the field to the other nearly all day. Well, I thought it was a job to be done, you know. But I was determined that I wasn't going to carry any So I called him outside and I said, I'm the British Sergeant Major. I said, in the British Army, I've got high rank and I do not do any labouring or any jobs. I give orders and supervise. I'm carrying no rocks. He said, you are, bud. I said, well, will you take me to your officer straight away? Because I want to inform your officer as well. And I'm a British Army Warrant Officer, Company Sergeant Major. And I don't want to stay here another day. I said, I demand to have transport immediately this day to take me from this place to a British camp, wherever it is. And I says, take it to your officer, and I should explain to him. I said, I don't want to be uncooperative, but I'm not carrying any rocks. So he took me to his officer, and he said, this guy tells me that he's not going to carry rocks, sir. So I saluted him, and I said, good morning, sir. I said, I'm a British Sergeant Major. I said, I'm willing to supervise the removal of rocks, but I'm not going to carry rocks myself. He said, British Army, we don't do the same. I have a senior rank, and I'm not here. I said, to stay. I want to be out today. Can you please arrange transport to get me to a British base camp, wherever it might be, from here? He said, yes, at Philippeville. He said, so you don't do things like this in the British Army? I said, no, sir, we don't. Thank you very much. He said, well, I understand. I fully understand. And I know that you're not one who will want to stay out of the line. He said, as some of these chaps do in the American Army, unfortunately. He said, I'll arrange forthwith for you to be kitted out with American clothes. He said, you'd better need it. He said, in a very short while, he said, this morning then, we'll see you off properly dressed. I said, with a bit better clothes than God, because I had filthy clothes on and I'd been in action. And I was absolutely bedraggled. He gave me two American shirts of super quality with pockets. He gave me an American blouse on, and an American trousers, an undervest, and he said, how does that suit you? I said, well, I said, that's all right, sir. I said, I don't think I'm allowed to wear these, incidentally. He said, it's all right. They take them off you when you get to the British camp, and you've got some decent clothing on while you get there. Well, I kept them. I was allowed to keep them. And I treasured them for a long, long time, I can assure you, because especially this blouse on. And I was taken to Philippeville, where it turned out to be the number six battalion infantry reinforcement training depot, IRTD, Philippeville. So on arrival, I was booked in and I told them that I was sorry about the Bishop St. David Salerno and American hospital trip and so forth. And the officer who interviewed me said, well, right. So he said, you're from the DLI, we're in Italy, a 60th battalion, and you were part of the American Fifth Army, and you came over, and you've been in an American hospital. It sounds very strange to me. I said, well, that's what happens. I said, we're under command of our club. So I said, you'll learn all about it later. I said, but it's true. I said, well, I'm not the only one, incidentally. But I said, I'm walking. I'm one of the first commanders. He said, yes, you are. He said, you can expect more than that. I said, oh, a hell of a lot. In the 1/3 American General Hospital. So anyway, he said, right. Well, he said, I'll hand you over to a Sergeant Major here who will accommodate you and show you where the mess is. He said, while you were here, are you prepared to help us out? So I said, it was me, sir. Well, he said, we're very short of staff here because we're not allowed to have anybody who is fit on the staff. And he said, and we are understaffed. He said, you've got to see the medical officer here. And he says, and he will tell you what to do from there. So he said, I'll see that you'll see the airport tomorrow morning. And then he said, this Sergeant Major needs a bit of help with his admin stuff. Can you help him out? He said, are you fit enough to do so? I said, oh yes. Apart from the fact that I'm sort of nearly deaf in my right ear. So So, I forget the sergeant major's name anyway, but he was an old chap. And he said, this is a hell of a place. He said, this is a base. He said, we're supposed to be a training depot. But he said, we have good staff. He said, we are understaffed. He says, I think one or two sergeant majors here as well. So he said, you're having him see the MO tomorrow morning. He said, we'll see what happens there. He said, you will please go back to the battalion. I said, yeah, I'm most getting back to the battalion. It was then that he told me that the previous day they had sent off a draft to the 16th Battalion, and that was the first reinforcement lot that they had in Italy from Philippeville, North Africa. That was the point I'd come to. So they were the first reinforcement sent at the battalion from Philippeville, including sergeant majors, and I looked at them all, and there was one CSM Thornton on the list. He took my place in the battalion, I understand, found out later. But anyway, I went to the MO and he said, you're not fit for the front line. He said, you're going to be good before the medical board. And the major going to happen. He said, the first thing you've got to do is to get you to attend the large hospital to see a specialist immediately. He says, that'll be within a matter of a day or two. I went to this hospital and saw this British brigadier bloke who said, you've been in an American hospital? I said, yes, sir. You could no damn right to be in an American hospital for treatment. He said, who sent you there? Well, I said, it was the drill from Salerno. He said, I've never heard of such nonsense in all my life. He said, you shouldn't have seen an American doctor. You should have seen a British doctor. Well, I said, we arrived, I said, and were met by the American ambulances from the hospital St. David's in West for the American hospital. He said, don't tell me that you didn't see the British. I said, I didn't have a word to say about it, sir. He said, the river saw to your ear, young man, has bloody ruined it. He said, you've got a hole there that will take a small ball bearing. He said, you're not going to hear with that ear anymore. He said, you've been treated abominably by whoever's done that. Well, I said, I was told that it was guinea pig treatment. He said, guinea pig treatment? He said, he's bloody ruined you for life. So, he said, I have to go before a medical board, because I can tell you now. He said, you won't go back into the front line with that. Time came, eventually, for this IRTD to move across the water to Italy. I was still with them, helping out in the capacity, until I saw a medical board.
What were you doing, specifically?
I was given a company, and I was receiving drafts from England. One sergeant major told me what I was doing. I didn't know what I had to do because I wasn't experienced in it, but I was receiving drafts from England. I was receiving ex-wounded from hospital, and I was the sergeant major of the company, who was, incidentally, which was a job that I couldn't fail to do because the important job of returns to second echelon, to records in York, to everywhere else was done by the existing staff, clerks, who were lance corporals and corporals, taking all their details and sending off the relevant information to the records offices at York and to O2E in Portici, Italy. So that every soldier O2E is office second echelon. And that is the records office of the Central Mediterranean Forces in Italy, where they had the army number, rank and name of every soldier in every unit in battle, in action in Italy. It was the records office for the Italian campaign.
And so were you in charge of these clerks?
So I was in charge of the clerks.
Yeah.
In this company.
Did you have any disciplinary duties
at all? No, it was a vast camp, and it was known as IRTD, and I said, well, I said, it's infantry reinforcement training depot. I said, what training was out here? He said, they're not here long enough to have any training. So I said, well, he said, that's the posh name they've given it. I suppose we're getting with a purpose. Medical has nothing to do with infantry. Infantry, IRTD, infantry reinforcement training depot.
And what kind of men were passing through this? Were they from all different regiments?
All the staff at the infantry reinforcement training depot, the IRTD, had to be invalids, not unfit men. There wasn't anybody employed there or allowed to be kept there apparently by orders of the High Command who were A1. They had to have something wrong with them. And they had all been downgraded to category, whatever it was. I went across the water to the new IRTD location near Caserta, which is General Alexander's headquarters, north of Naples, about half an hour behind the front line. And the IRTD was transferred, their lock, stock, and barrel from Philippeville to Cerveniara, a place in the mountains north of Naples, just beyond Caserta, on a place called Maddaloni. It was in the Benevento region, which is a mountainous region, not very far behind the front line. What they did, they moved slugs from America to Africa, and they had full authority to commandeer whatever land they observed would be suitable for the purpose. They commandeered grape vineyards that were in this region on a gentle slope with grapes growing everywhere, big rows in between the grapes. So it was ready-made camp. All they did was put up tents in between the grapes. So they formed A, B, C, D company of the IRTD in this place in Italy. And I was transferred to C company. And where there was a chap called Captain Dabbs, D-A-W-S, of the Recce regiment. He had been badly wounded in the leg, and he apparently had one leg slightly shorter than the other. Because although he could walk, but he could walk quite fast, he had a stick. But you could see that he had a half an inch difference in one leg, I think. And he was a very clean-cut, efficient officer of the Recce. And I was to be a sergeant major. So we got on like a house on fire from the very beginning, actually, because he knew of the history of the battalion in North Africa. The lieutenant colonel in charge of the IRTD here was a lieutenant colonel Haygate, ex-Royal West Kents, the Buffs. He handed over Green Hill to us, the 16th, when we moved into Green Hill from Gardimau. He was also in the Battle of Seginain and was at Djebel Abiod. And he was a very sick man. He was yellow from jaundice caused by malaria. And that's why he was relieved of his command in the Royal West Kents. But he was our CO, Colonel Haygate. A very nice chap as well, and I got to know him very well. And anyway, Captain Dabbs was a good organizer, so he had to set up camp. And C Company was going to be here, in this grape vine, in this grape, one of which, you know, slope. Commandeered from the Italians, who didn't have a say in it. Signs went up, "E vietato l'ingresso senza permesso." It is forbidden to enter without permission. And we built a rampart so that they couldn't sort of get in. We had earth at the opening of the company entrance with steps going up so that nothing could come in. But there was, on each side of the steps, of course, land that could have been used if anybody wanted to sort of go in. And that was where it was there. But anyway, Captain Baird had his tents. They were Indian tents. Heavy sort of Indian cloth, you know. And lines. And Which worked for a bit because we didn't have a night bar. It rained like blazes when it did, and these craters, believe it or not, eventually filled up with water right to the top. And indeed, the waves were so heavy that the ground, the water level must have been such that the water was burning away. And these bomb craters were chock-a-block with water, rain water. All around the downtown. That was the snag, the snag, the big job, sort of thing. We didn't have bulldozers or any equipment, they were left. For some reason, I often wondered why. They could have been filled in, but I don't know. But anyway, I'm pursuing that. So we were really very efficient at one of the campus. We had the Scottish regiments. I was responsible as the sergeant major of this C company, for everybody who came to C company of the 6th IRTD, just behind the line now in the casino. I had the Seaforth Highlanders, the Gordon Highlanders, the Cameronians, the Cameron Highlanders, the Kingswood Scottish Borders, Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders. They were all jocks, Glaswegians, and they were tough soldiers. I had a deal with the new men coming from the UK to reinforce these particular Scottish regiments. And anybody in those regiments came to C Company, 6 IRTD, to me. And they had to be documented, and they were there, and they were kits inspected, and they had tents, and they were told to live there. This was their new home by the way, they were going to comply with the discipline, they weren't allowed out unless we give permission. There's a little village called Pailisi, about a mile up the road, where they were heading. Stuff that blinded you. You know, concoctions of wood alcohol, human urine, and a little dash of vermouth to give it flavour. And they were selling this to troops, and some of the troops were, you know, it was enough to blind you, really. It was wood alcohol.
Did you ever drink any?
I want everybody not to do something, but they did, St. Bagger's. And a lot of them were casualties.
What was the general standard of the troops that were passing through at this stage? Or do you think they were of a high standard in terms of the fitness, their mentality?
They were supposed to be A1 and fit. Now, in addition to these come back in England, of course, they were all A1 and fit, and fully kitted as well. And fresh troops for the battle. We also had, of course, the casualties from ex-hospital who were driven through, who had been wounded, not too bad, but who then had a period of recuperation, and they were discharged from medical the English hospitals and sent to the base, not going back to the line. Those chaps were difficult to deal with. They didn't realise that everybody on the staff had to be downgraded and an unfit man. They thought, looking at me, that I was a smart bullshitter, A1. They didn't know that I'd been. By now, I'd been to Naples, and I was downgraded, I went before the medical board, and I was downgraded to B1 permanent.
Can you describe how that process worked, and what the medical board was?